This is the story. The amazing story of a shoplifter who bore a famous name. And you'll hear another story. The amusing story of a great career that began with a hacking cough. Yes, this is the story.
In the areaway, just beyond the steady stream of customers that poured in and out the swinging doors, a sleek, well-dressed gentleman paused and took a deep breath. It was a summer day, but his hands were two lumps of solid ice, and his heart was pounding louder than the horse's hooves on the nearby thoroughfare. Now, he told himself, now was the time. Now he must take the plunge. But still he hesitated, looking around for some excuse, any excuse to justify another moment's delay. He found it in a mirror that hung from the wall in the rear of the showcase window. He caught a glimpse of his own face staring back at him. He examined it as coolly, as critically as he could. No, no, thank heavens, the panic in his breast was not written on his features. He looked calm and serene and dignified. What was more important, he looked honest. No one in the whole world would ever suspect the nature of the mission on which he was bent. And with this reassuring thought, grimly clenching his fists, he entered the store. One glance around served to increase his assurance. It was a busy hour. Men and women surged back and forth in the aisles, clustered around counters, fingered the merchandise, talked and argued and bargained and carefully counted their change. He was one among thousands, he thought, unnoticed and unknown. And that was the way it should be, the way it had to be if he were to escape detection. He moved slowly toward a counter. It was covered with tie clasps and stick pins. The metal objects gleamed brightly under the lights, catching his eye, luring him, drawing him to them. He was standing over them now. There was one set with a green stone, one lying at the very edge of the counter. He would need only to raise his hand. And he did raise it. It hovered for a second over the pin, descended slowly, and then...
That stick pin, sir, are you interested in buying it?
Well, it was all he could do to keep himself from crying out. It took every ounce of his strength to glance up casually and to smile.
No, I was merely admiring it.
The salesman turned away, and it was at that instant, with a sudden surge of courage, that he accomplished the thing he had set out to accomplish. With a swift, silent gesture, he lifted the stick pin from the counter and dropped it into his pocket. His knees were quaking as he walked on down the aisle. He felt the flush of hot blood in his cheeks, but under his breath, triumphantly, he told himself,
I've done it. By George, I've done it. I've stolen something for the first time in my life.
But this, he knew, was only the beginning. He must steal more than a stick pin. He must steal everything in sight. At the next counter, there were toilet articles. He'd gained confidence from his first success, and this time he didn't hesitate. Into his pocket went a bar of soap. Then he moved on, and his heart was no longer pounding, and his hands were warm. Why, no one had even noticed him. No one had paid the slightest attention. Why, he could go on doing this all day, and who would be the wiser? He paused at the toy counter and appropriated a rubber ball. Soon a doll's dress joined the stick pin and the soap and the ball. His pockets were bulging. Still, there might be room for one thing more. That claw hammer there, for instance. That would do nicely. His hand flashed out and seized the handle. And it was then that iron fingers closed about his wrist.
What do you think you're doing, mister? You can't get away with that. Let you and me pay a call on the manager and be sure you bring that hammer along.
And in a moment, his arm still in a vice-like grip of the policeman, he was standing face to face with the manager, and the policeman was explaining,
I just happened to be doing a little shopping myself, sir, and I caught him stealing this hammer. I suggest you let me lock him up.
But before the manager could answer, a strange thing happened. The sleek, well-dressed gentleman wrenched his arm loose. He reached into his pockets and brought it all out. All of the merchandise, all of the dozens of assorted articles he had stolen.
Yeah.
He threw them down in a pile on the desk before the manager's astonished eyes. And in a voice that rang with recrimination, he cried,
There wasn't just the hammer I stole. It was all these things. And if this officer hadn't happened to come along, I never would have been caught. Is this the way your clerks guard against shoplifters? Is this the way they protect my store?
His store? The manager rose slowly to his feet. Who was he? And what in name of heaven was he doing here? To which the gentleman replied,
I just wanted to see how easy it was to steal my merchandise, and now I know. You tell your clerks to be more alert hereafter, and tell them those are orders from the boss.
And the boss is exactly what he was. For you see, this was the man who had built not only that establishment, but a chain of others like it throughout the state. A chain that was to expand and grow until it covered the entire country. the man who had first instituted the practice of laying merchandise on open counters and selling it at the lowest possible price. Yes, this shoplifter who had stolen from his own clerks to teach them a lesson was the founder of a great American fortune, the famous merchant and financial genius, the originator of the 5- and 10-cent store, F.W. Woolworth. This is the story. The landlady heard them close the door behind them. She heard their footsteps crossing the porch and receding down the stairs. And then, when she knew they were gone, when there was no hope of recalling them, she began to regret what she had done. She would never have agreed to it, but they were such a handsome couple, so distinguished, so obviously rich and famous. How could she resist them? The man had done the talking, and he had done it with great persuasion.
There's nothing to worry about, really, Mrs. Petrie. We shall be gone long, and the children are quite able to take care of themselves. And if there should be any problem, well, their grandmother's in town, and of course you know where to find her.
Oh, yes, Mrs. Petrie knew where to find their grandmother. Everyone in the city knew that, for she was famous, too. Indeed, it was an honor to the boarding house that children such as these, the offspring of such an illustrious family, should be left in her care. And yet, Mrs. Petrie couldn't help but worry something might happen to them, and she would be responsible. No wonder poor Mrs. Petrie had so little appetite that night at dinner. No wonder she sat with her soup untouched before her, oblivious of all the other boarders, her eyes fastened on the handsome faces of the three children. And no wonder her heart sank within her as Mr. Petrie leaned toward her and murmured quietly,
"The girl don't look right to me. She's pale. I wonder if she's coming down with something."
It was true. Oh, it was unquestionably true. Mrs. Petrie herself had sensed it, but she had lacked the courage to admit it. Quickly she rose and moved around the table to the little girl's side. She bent to whisper in her ear. Wasn't she feeling well, she asked? Did something hurt her somewhere? But the little girl shook her head. No, Mrs. Petrie mustn't worry. She was feeling all right. At least, she was feeling as well as could be expected. And having uttered these mysterious words, the child, the daughter of the illustrious family, firmly closed her lips and refused to say more. Mrs. Petrie retired early that night, but she found it difficult to sleep. She was tormented by memories of the evening, the memory of that uneaten meal. Even the ice cream had been untouched. Of the child lying in the living room afterward, lethargic and silent. Of the pallor in her cheeks and the deep, dark circles beneath her eyes. Just then, the bedroom door opened and Mr. Petrie came in. Softly, he called to his wife, and when she answered him, he told her the news, the shocking, terrifying news.
"It's the little girl. I just passed by her room. She's got a coughing fit of some kind. It's an awful hacking cough."
In an instant, Mrs. Petrie was on her feet. Throwing her robe around her, she fled down the stairs. Swiftly, silently, she approached the door. She held her breath and listened. And then she heard it. A dry, desperate, strangling cough. The cough of a child who is perilously ill, who might even be on the brink of death. She threw open the door, and at the spectacle that greeted her eyes, her heart stopped, and she uttered a cry of horror. The child lay back on her pillows, gasping for breath. At her bedside, kneeling, their faces distorted with sorrow, their eyes filled with tears, were her two brothers. Mrs. Petrie said nothing. She turned wildly and ran. 15 minutes later, she stood backstage in a downtown theater, pounding on a dressing room door. A tall, dignified woman admitted her, and the distraught landlady cried that the great actress must come at once, that her grandchild was dying. Soon, the carriage was speeding through the streets, stopping only once on the way to summon the city's most capable doctor. And then at last, they were back in the boarding house, the actress and the landlady, standing tense and silent outside the door, while the eminent physician ministered to the child. They were strangers, these two women. They came from different worlds. But now they clutched each other close in a common fear, a common grief. At length, the door opened, and the doctor emerged. They waited in terrible suspense for his words. He glanced at them and smiled. Yes, smiled. And then he inquired calmly,
"I presume both of you are familiar with the Dumas play, Camille."
Camille? Mrs. Petrie stared at him in bewilderment. Camille was the play about the beautiful woman who suffered from tuberculosis. But what on earth did that have to do with the child? And the doctor replied,
"Everything. It seems that she and her brothers have been rehearsing their parts. They've decided to do Camille, and the little girl is to play the lead. That is the nature of her illness."
And hearing these words, the child's grandmother threw back her head and shook with laughter. For she knew then what others have learned since, that the talent of her family, the love of the theater was in their blood, was not to be denied. Even at that tender age, the granddaughter of Mrs. John Drew gave her first performance, and it was just as convincing as the thousands that she has given since. For the little girl who wanted to play Camille has become one of the greatest figures on the American stage. And her name, like the names of her brothers and her parents and grandparents before her, will live as long as the theater itself. The name of Ethel Barrymore. This is the story.